are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
We're sponsored this week by Decode DC, the podcast that gives you an honest look into how politics affects your life. The host of Decode DC, Jimmy Williams. You got to hear this guy. He's worked for Republicans, for Democrats, and even as a lobbyist. He's taking all that experience and he's explaining how things really work inside and outside of Washington. Decode DC is smart, surprising, and it challenges the conventional wisdom, like in a recent episode about how Donald Trump might deal with his conflicts of interest or not deal with them, or when he talks about the moving day at the White House as told by somebody who really lived through it. And that always was actually something fascinating to me. You got to listen to the show. Check it out. I did. I think you'll love it. That's Decode DC, available on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, February 6, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks, and I'm Michael Monday, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Michael Cunican on why Republicans are impressive, how a fringe party with an extremist agenda has continued to dominate American politics in spite of all the odds. What Democrats can learn from them? Can Democrats ever get ruthless and understand how power really works? We'll be talking about that. Also, resistance. Is it working? Yes, to some extent. A sweeping stay from a judge, a circuit court judge in Seattle. At the same time as Republicans are scurrying like ferrets and weasels from town halls where constituents are demanding to know what they will do if they strip their health care from them. Stay on the streets. Keep the calls going. It's the only way that we can avert a complete catastrophe orchestrated by hashtag President Bannon. And is that hashtag starting to upset Mr. Donald Trump, our president? Looks like it might be. He's taken to Twitter. But do Bannon and Trump have a mind meld deeper than Trump's usual appetite for things? And is that a mind meld rooted in a deep commitment to ethno-nationalist racism? We'll get into that. Also, new sanctions on Iran, actually not as aggressive as they could have been. We'll keep monitoring that. Marie Le Pen officially announces she's running for president in France, leading with a triple attack on globalization, Islam, and the European Union. Fascism has a different hybrid in France. We'll check in on that election. And the Chinese Communist Party warns that war between China and the United States isn't really something that would be like inevitable and fun to speculate about on a podcast. It would actually be a disaster for the world. In the bizarre situation we find ourselves in, where we rely on the Chinese Communist Party maybe to have some rationality more than our administration. I can't talk about the Super Bowl. I couldn't watch it because I can't root for the Pats anymore. Last year, if this had happened, I would have come in with the most obnoxious, like, dude, I think they did it on purpose so that the Falcons thought they had it just to F with them, dude. Boston. I can't do it anymore. I skipped it. I was actually doing some stuff in Jersey yesterday, and I timed it so I would be coming back to the city. I didn't want to watch it. It's the first Super Bowl I've missed in years. And I'm not like Lady Gaga. I mean, I'm not mad at her, but that's not a halftime performance I need to see. So
I didn't do anything crazy, but I watched the game and had a few beers with some friends. And I don't like getting involved in the sort of partisan of sports. I like to be nonpartisan in sports. Just enjoy the good athletics going on. But I realized after like the first couple minutes that I was definitely rooting for
Matt Luck enjoys the good athletics going on.
It's how the game is played. I realized in my gut deep down, I was definitely rooting for the Falcons whenever they'd break off a large run.
Yep.
And so I was enjoying it for the most part of the game, but I also was smart enough to know that like that this is probably going to come to an end. So I didn't get involved in the sort of pre-gloating celebrations, thinking that we were going to take down Tom Brady in a sort of anti-fascist victory, but I knew it was going to happen, so here we are.
It was really depressing.
I realized 0 minutes in that I didn't know that it was happening and also was not going to watch it and was rooting for no one. And a couple hours later, I realized that it had happened. And then I Googled it and was annoyed that the Patriots won and realized that all my shows I wanted to watch were preempted. So then it sucked.
All around suckitude. Okay. A couple. Now, I Saturday Night Live, they're kind of killing it. This sketch is important. We're going to open with some sound. In the same way that you can directly influence the president's opinion through Morning Joe or by tweeting at him, these Saturday Night Live sketches might have serious consequences for the management of global and domestic affairs. Steve Bannon, we're going to be talking about him more, obviously. He's an incredibly dangerous, disturbing presence. But this, what I love about this sketch is I think just the idea that Bannon is orchestrating everything is going to make Trump go nuts. And also, the part of this sketch over the weekend where Trump is calling random foreign leaders to try to, you know, intimidate them, there's part of these jokes here where I have never thought that a certain comedic sensibility that I have would ever be so much in the mainstream before. So let's look and listen to, depending on your medium of choice, some of this last weekend's SNL Steve Bannon Donald Trump sketch.
That was hilarious.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you. Oh, I just had a great idea. Watch this.
Hello?
Hello, congratulations. You've just won a free cruise for two to Hawaii. All we need is your country's credit card number.
We're not paying for the wall, Donald.
Yes, you are. Steve, all of our so-called allies are being so mean to me.
Why don't you call some random little country and show them who's boss?
What about Zimbabwe?
Perfect. Show them the might of America.
Hello?
Zimbabwe, there's a new sheriff in town.
Wait, is this Donald Trump?
Yes.
You think you are a big tough dictator? I will rip out your spine and drink from your skull. You cannot even walk downstairs, you little white bitch. Don't you ever call Zimbabwe again.
Donald, that's enough fun for tonight. Can I have my desk back?
Yes, of course, Mr. President. I'll go sit at my desk. Yeah. It's so much fun. I love it.
Yes, this is fun. And live from New York, it's Saturday night!
All right, that's the best coverage that Robert Mugabe has received in Western media since at least the 1980s. I feel like a sketch where the president of Zimbabwe threatens to drink Trump's blood and calls him a little white bitch is definitely something I could have written or performed on this show. So I appreciated that. And the last part of that, where Trump goes and what is it? I don't know what they're called, like a slinky.
It's
or
like
something.
One of those expanding sort of universe toys,
right?
Things that you
goes to his mini desk and gives it back to President Bannon. Now it's funny, but what makes it hysterical is you know that Trump watched it, got infuriated, and Bannon took a break from devising an ethnic cleansing plot because he had an anxiety attack, because he knows that that's the type of thing that puts his job in jeopardy. And we saw this tweet that dropped. Okay. Well, no, you don't have the tweet up. Okay. All right. We'll get to that later. But
I looked up what that toy was. Because especially if you were just listening, you couldn't see. But Bannon said, "Let me have my desk back," and then took the big desk. And there was Trump went over to a miniature one, and he played with a toy. And that toy is called a Hoberman sphere.
A Hoberman sphere. Hashtag President Bannon is having an effect. Let me talk about movement watches. Movement watches were started by two broke kids that wanted to wear stylish watches but couldn't afford them. MVMT, Movement Watches, was founded in the belief that style shouldn't break the bank. And, you know, we know all about this. This is how you launch a podcast. This is how you launch a show on YouTube. Today's world, you can cut out a lot of middlemen, go directly to your audience and produce, you know, hopefully a superior product. That's certainly what Movement is doing in the watch game. So far, by selling their products entirely online, Movement was able to cut out the middleman as well as the retail markup and provide you with the best prices possible. Watches starting at $95. That's a fraction of what department store brands typically charge. This revolutionary pricing, along with the product's classic design, quality construction, and styled minimalism, has led to over 500,000 watches sold in 160 countries. And as we've said, you know, Sam got it for Nikki. It's a major win. This is a very good Valentine gift. I need to get on that. So step up your watch game and see why people across the world love Movement Watches. Just go to movementwatches.com/majority and get 15% off today, plus with free shipping and free returns. Grab one for Valentine's before it's too late. That's MVMTwatches.com/majority. MVMTwatches.com/majority. Join the movement. There's a link on our website.
They're beautiful watches.
They're beautiful watches.
It's true.
It's really true. Now, let's talk about Blue Apron. Not all ingredients are created equal. Fresh, high-quality ingredients make a real difference, so it's important to know where your food comes from. Thankfully, for less than $10 a person per meal, Blue Apron delivers easy-to-follow recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients, courtesy of over 150 local farms, ranches, and fisheries across the country, across the United States, right to your door. And because Blue Apron ships the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe, there's no food to waste. It's everything you need to make sustainable, delicious, home-cooked meals for 40 minutes or less. Some of the meals available in February include cashew chicken stir fry with tango mandarins and jasmine rice. Man, udon noodle soup with miso and soft boiled eggs. That's going to be the go-to right there. Roasted pork with apple, walnut, and farro salad, and crispy barramundi with quinoa and roasted carrot salad. Whole new worlds of eating opened up here. Check out this week's menu and get the first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/majority. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/majority. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. One more great service I got to tell you about. Okay. Anyone out there in human resources or HR, human resources or HR, the good listeners in my audience who manage resources that are human, I've got a special message for you. As you always do, listen up. I want to talk about Bamboo HR. This is something that's really designed if you're managing at a kind of smaller scale, like this business, as an example, would benefit a lot from Bamboo. Bamboo HR is the number one HR management software for small to medium-sized businesses. One simple central system for keeping organized, detailed records for every employee, and automated countless tasks for HR. No more file cabinets, no more spreadsheets, no more messy whiteboards. accessible through the cloud at any location. Did you forget to log in on an employee's time off or forget that they were out last Monday? Bamboo HR has you covered. Do you have a confidential salary history filled in employee files? Bamboo HR will secure the data and keep accurate records for you. So simple and so delightful to use, you won't need instructions. Everything in one place. Job and salary history, vacation and sick days, benefits, onboarding, training history, performance reviews, and so much more. And now we have a limited time offer. Right now you can try Bamboo HR for free for 14 days. That's right. Kick the tires. Take it for a spin. Just visit bamboo-h-r.com. Click on the mic and enter my code REPORT to get a free 14-day trial. Try it and you'll wonder how you ever got along without it. That's bamboo-h-r.com. Enter my code REPORT. Link on the website. Fresh Two Dope Boys is dropping tomorrow. We had a great live show at Ignition One for Two Dope Boys, and some people asked me, they wanted to do a meetup with me. So if you're in the city, just tweet at me at _MichaelBrooks, and we'll figure something like that out soon. We'll be right back with Michael Kinukin, on the Majority Report.
Gone to rest. Only King Selassie could help with this time. Give we back the good and take the bad out of your mind. We all make it seem to be impossible to live our life. Worship and vanity could never be the way, cause it's just not right. Let us live together, let us all unite. Striking the serpent, conquering beasts by their tail. Only rapids, only destined human to feel. Eyes against each other like sharks and whales. Where is all the righteousness? All I see is filthiness. Peace and love has gone to rest. Only King Selassie could help with this time. Give we back the love and take the battle to your mind. Get the wicked out the way. Rasta Mosiah come free, teach them how free play. In a Babylon too much youths are get slain. Follow Marcus Siege and you will never go astray. Only Emmanuel King Selassie I lead the way. Yeah, where is all the righteousness?
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Michael Kinukin. He's a writer based in Brooklyn and editor of the Hypocrite Reader. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Michael, you wrote a really, really important piece in Current Affairs called Why Republicans Are Impressive. This is sort of like a blueprint, basically, for how a party that pursues a relentlessly narrow and radical agenda, which we see, and I think it's important that, you know, you didn't just focus on the Trump dimension of it and the white nationalism and this new iteration. You focused on the Republican congressional agenda, which is a sustained and radical and vicious attack on middle-class people, on poor people certainly, and, you know, stands on advocating positions that are well outside of the American mainstream. And you explain why they're politically rewarded for this, sort of in contrast to conventional wisdom about political persuasion. But before we get to that, can you give an example? You think you talk about Medicaid as an example where Republicans have targeted an effective program that is widely popular, widely beneficial. There's no policy crisis there. There's no actual reason to do anything about Medicaid, and it's certainly popular, yet they've been waging a war on it for decades and winning.
Yes, that's exactly right. So Medicaid is a great example because it's a very large program. It helps as many as 63 million people, and it's very popular, and it provides, you know, desperately needed health care to the American poor. And what you see is not fringe people, but very major people within the Republican House leadership, people like Tom Price and Paul Ryan, who have been for decades, I mean, them and their predecessors, advocating various ways to destroy Medicaid, the most popular of which being block granting it, right. i.e. sort of capping benefits and giving power over to the states to cut it.
So that does two mm-hmm. things just really quickly. It basically would mean that it's making a program that instead of just sort of naturally rising, like it's a recession, more people need Medicaid, so there's going to be, you know, if you meet an eligibility, it would sort of do away with that, and then also, yeah, it would turn away a fixed amount to the states, and then obviously there's plenty of states that already you know, practice austerity and don't invest in needed public services, so it would be cut. Anyway, go ahead.
That's exactly right. And those two things are related because in a recession, state governments really hit fiscal problems, right? Their tax revenue goes down, and they need to cut just when people need help most.
Right.
So giving a welfare program over to the states in a block grant form is a powerful way to sort of destroy it without saying you're destroying it. This was pioneered in the Clinton administration with TANF, temporary assistance for needy families.
Right.
And it's, again, so this is the agenda of very powerful people within the Republican legislature. And what's striking to me about this, and you could say the same thing about Medicare. Paul Ryan and Tom Price and others have called for making Medicare a premium support program, which means instead of just paying, providing insurance to the elderly, we would give them some money and let them buy their own insurance on the market, which of course would be absolutely disastrous. And what's striking about these is not only that they're awful, because of course, I mean, Republican policy for the poor and for the elderly is awful, but also that they're deeply, deeply unpopular, and yet you see very major figures within the Republican establishment pushing very hard for them.
Right.
And that strikes me especially because when you talk to major sort of senior Democrats about big, important reforms, you know, stuff like single-payer healthcare, pre-college, that kind of thing, you'll often hear, look, no one's ever going to go for that. We'd love to do it, but it's not a very, you know, it's not popular. It's never going to get passed. But, like, single-payer is way, way more popular than cutting Medicare.
Right. Medicare, so you quote polling, I think it's from Kaiser, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, only 13% of Americans support slashing Medicaid. And, you know, that's a marginal number at best. And, you know, and of course, like within that 13%, I'm sure it's, you know, overrepresentative of either, you know, people who are, you know, completely devotees of sort of crazy fringe right-wing media content or, you know, literally themselves, you know, plutocrats who personally maybe got polled and would like to see people thrown into deeper sort of suffering and poverty. So, before we get into the Democratic kind of weakness, and I think there's a lot to tease out there because I think there's ideological and material reasons for that, explain, though, how is it that, you know, because again, on its face, there's a certain logic to it, right? Like, these are incredibly unpopular proposals. The country is, you know, changing demographically. Where is the profit for Republicans in this belligerence? Now, there must be material and ideological reasons there as well. As an example, if you're, you know, in a gerrymandered district or representing an extremist agenda that speaks specifically to your constituents, then, you know, your political calculus is different than running a national campaign. But explain more just about how Republicans have maintained and profited from this sort of fanaticism. And then we'll get to the Democratic contrast.
That's a great question. So I would say two questions are, how do they profit from it and how do they maintain it?
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of maintenance, what's striking about the Republicans is that for many years, they've had very powerful donors, very far to the right of the mainstream of the party, mm-hmm. who were very, very willing to aggressively primary people
right.
in those gerrymandered districts, but also elsewhere. Primary anyone who sort of who hewed to a more moderate line. So there's a very aggressive enforcement of party discipline. Gerrymandering clearly matters. It does matter because Republicans in very red districts only have to compete with other Republicans over right. ideological purity. But so does just the willingness of elements within the party to even risk losing some elections in order to really bring the pain to legislators who are moderate on social issues or moderate on welfare issues.
Right.
And many, many people over the years have said, especially in the last 4 years of the Obama administration, said that this was going to ultimately kill the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. That ultimately you couldn't have these wingnuts running anywhere except deep red territory. You couldn't have that party platform and win a national election. But what we've seen on the contrary is that this has been an extremely successful political project. You know, not only do the Republicans control the entire federal government, but they've been very, very, very successful on lower down on the ticket in state legislatures, in governors' mansions right. around the country.
Right.
And I think that brings in the other dimension of this story, which is that not only so there's donors and there's extremist donors who are willing to fund these primary campaigns, but there's also the Republican base. Which is very highly mobilized mm-hmm. and really gets turned on by the idea of, you know, making abortion illegal, cutting welfare, this kind of thing.
Right.
And you see, like, if you look at, you know, the big Tea Party wave in 2010, where a huge number of very radical GOP congressmen got elected, you see a lot of those people are not party insiders. They're people who were, you know, doing something else with their lives. They were a doctor. They were a small businessman.
Right.
And really got mobilized by the first couple of years of the Obama administration and were willing to run against the party machine in their district. And
with financial support. See, that's another thing, you know, when we'll get to it because there's a couple of things that have happened recently that put some wrinkles into this, but I think that the what you've identified there that's so important is that they're willing to run against a certain part of the local machine, but with an unlimited paycheck or campaign contributions, rather, from some of the plutocrats you were talking about before. So they can actually play, they could play a double game where on one hand they could say, I'm an insurgent against an unresponsive incumbent, but I also, as soon as I come out and, you know, even with the vaguest type of credibility, commit to a fanatic far-right agenda, I know that Pope in North Carolina or the Koch brothers or the, you know, any of these radical plutocrat families will open up the bank vault. So you get bust of both worlds.
I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, I think that it speaks to an asymmetry between the Democrats and the Republicans, where the Democrats also have their radical wing, but it is much less well-financed.
Right, right.
You know, $27 donations only get you so far, and so it's been much less effective in enforcing its vision on the party.
Right. So we'll get to that. But before we do, because I think those are some questions that sort of are harbingers of the future. But before we get there, you've laid out this case really well, just like you did in the article, that through money, gerrymandering, and organization and aggression, Republicans have maintained and profited from extremism. Now, the argument of the type of, you know, weak Democrats, for lack of a better term, that we're talking about, has been a couple of different sort of responses that maybe we can sort of run through and debunk. So one has been, you know, that long delayed boomerang effect, which is that, and occasionally it does happen, but it's, you know, it's reactive. I mean, we saw the height of it in 2008. People were fed up with Republican corruption, extremism, Iraq. And then, you know, Democrats won this overwhelming victory. We'll get to that in a moment. So it's not like it doesn't ever happen that there's a backlash. But the notion that, like you said before, this party just keeps burrowing and burrowing deeper into its far-right extremes, even as the country is changing demographically and culturally, even as, you know, things like cutting Medicaid remain incredibly unpopular. So inevitably, it has to backlash, right? And kind of like the height of this was the Clinton campaign. It wasn't even run on a backlash of policy proposals. It was literally just a backlash of like, come on, Donald Trump's an asshole. There's no way you could vote for him. And so, mm-hmm. you know, that was like the logical extreme of that positioning. And it didn't even work against the friggin', you know, predator game show host. So Explain why the assumption that radicalism would get punished hasn't worked. And through that, I think you can kind of explain, you know, the myth of the center and what American politics actually kind of looks like.
I see. Yeah. Yeah. So I think there are two reasons why this sort of backlash mostly doesn't happen, or at least that happens very, very slowly. The most important one is that a lot of people have this idea that there's this American mainstream sort of like the average voter, you know, wants things to be pretty much the way they are with a few changes. And then there's sort of fewer extremists on both sides who want big changes. Mm-hmm. I think what that misses is that the vast majority of Americans are nowhere near the center. We live in a very partisan country, where, you know, 40 or even 45% of voters on each side, so 90% of everyone, just sort of is deeply influenced by what each party holds as its mainstream position. Mm-hmm. And there are really very few views so extreme that if a major party in the United States decided to take them, it would be anathema to the rest of the country. So the example I gave in the article was, you know, thinking that global warming is a Chinese hoax is a pretty wild idea. And yet, you know, 40% of Americans believe something approximating that. And why do they believe it? Well, because it's what their party believes. Mm-hmm. So Democrats tend to see voters' views as fixed and to sort of maneuver around those views, whereas Republicans realize that if they, as a major party in this country, bring a coherent messaging strategy to an issue, they're going to be very effective in shaping public opinion around that issue.
Yeah, so I think that's true. And now we get, you know, I think to some complications inside Democrats and maybe now potentially with Republicans when we see this kind of backlash with what's happening with Obamacare. But, you know, I think that that's definitely true. And we see, you know, at the very least, I mean, people coming out of the Bernie Sanders world and, you know, all these groups popping up like Justice Democrats that are at the very least trying to say like, okay, at the bare minimum, why don't we at least be the you know, the party of issues that in fact already are overwhelmingly popular? Like, you don't even need to massage and bring people over. A vast majority of people, you know, want strong, robust Medicaid. If you get into the details of the polling on Obamacare, there's, you know, certainly that constitutes something like a majority that either want to preserve it or, in fact, to the extent they want to change it, they want to make it significantly more progressive and less neoliberal. We need to have an inequality agenda, you know, at the very least, campaign on what's popular. And I think that that is, though, what illustrates part of the problem that Democrats have had in the past in doing what you're talking about, which I agree they need to do. And part of it is that, you know, one is that it's clearly a party that ironically is much more conservative. It has infinitely more respect for institutional legacies. I mean, we see it even in today's world. We have this, you know, demented extremist administration that's also incompetent. And then we have, you know, a Congress that is ready to go for broke on sort of bringing us back to before the New Deal. And mm-hmm. you know, and we still see people on the Democratic side saying, well, you know, I mean, it's the notion that there's adult grown people saying two wrongs don't make a right when they're discussing, you know, how to deal with a Supreme Court pick on a stolen Supreme Court seat is, I mean, it would kind of be funny if it wasn't so shocking, delusional, and dangerous. So,
yep.
you know, so part of it is managerial. And, you know, actually, let's take them in part. I'll get to the material part secondly. But what do you think? And also that in the past, and I think it's changing now, in the past, if you looked at poll numbers during the Obama administration, and part of it might be what you're saying, which is that partisans are influenced by their leaders, and Obama always preached moderation and bipartisanship, so there's truth to that. But Democrats steadily as a group have always been more sympathetic in terms of polling. There's always more Democrats that identify as moderate than Republicans identify as moderate versus conservative. There's always more Democrats that have said, yeah, we need to reach out and build compromise. So it also seems that institutionally and as a party of professionals and elites and technocrats, there isn't that same sort of uniformity of fanaticism that Republicans have. And that's the ideological cultural piece. We'll get to the material piece in a second, but can you address that first?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And I think there are a number of causes of that. One I would point to is it's important to understand about the current Democratic leadership that its historical memory goes back to the Reagan wave in the mm-hmm. 80s and mm-hmm. to the sort of almost traumatic experience of seeing this huge Republican majority emerge after, you know, decades of Democrats being the party of government. And to, you know, Bill Clinton's response to that, which was essentially to take over a lot of Republican talking points, a lot of Reagan Republican talking points, but to say, we're going to do it, but less so. Yeah. You know, we're going to cut welfare, but in a more moderate way. We're going to roll back the state, but in a more moderate way. Right. And I think at that moment, the Democrats, on the one hand, gained very, you know, started winning elections. On the other hand, really lost their coherent ideological center. Mm-hmm. You know, they stopped defining themselves as the party of the New Deal and the Great Society, and found themselves in this place where they're sort of the party of what? The status quo?
Mm-hmm.
In stark contrast to, really, if you listen to Republican rhetoric and sort of internal speeches, they understand themselves as a party that is fighting a war.
Right.
To take their country back, basically, from the entire legacy of the New Deal and the Great Society. So the Republicans know better what they're about than the Democrats do. I would add that I think a lot of younger Democrats who don't have this sort of Reagan memory tend to project onto the Democratic leadership a much stronger ideological position than actually exists.
Mm-hmm.
So you hear sort of, you know, younger Democrats who, for instance, supported Clinton in the primary saying, look, I'm sure Clinton would love to make us into Sweden, but she knows it's impossible. That's actually not so clear.
Right.
Democrats of that generation, you know, they're genuine, authentic moderates. That's how they came up, and that's where they stand. So it's definitely a mistake to see the Democrats as sort of trying but failing to push a radical agenda. Their agenda just isn't that radical, and it has really prevented them from seeing what the modern Republican Party is, from imagining such an ambitious political project. They really don't understand how committed, how authentically committed these people are, and how far they'll go.
Right. No doubt about that. And I think so. What also, though, relates to that. So, and I'll use a sort of indirect example to get there. But it's like if you look at a client list of some Republican consulting firm, you'll usually see it's very synchronized and coherent. It's like I work to elect candidates that are anti-labor, anti-environment, that will make life worse for most people. And then I have clients, you know, corporate clients like Walmart or, you know, whoever else who share a similar agenda to extract, to entrench inequality, and to make life, in fact, worse for most people. If you go to a Democrat consulting shop, a Democratic consulting shop, and I think it's this is something that actually has been shifting, but I always remembered, you know, I was researching this, you know, this was around the time of Obama's first election, and I was in college, and you looked at a group like Stan Greenberg's consulting firm, and I actually think Stan Greenberg's a pollster who, you know, certainly from the Democratic mainstream is actually much more sophisticated and intelligent about these things. But you would see, like, okay, you worked for Nelson Mandela, you know, you worked for Human Rights Watch, but then also Monsanto, Boeing, and BP. And, you know, it's like it's just not synchronized. And mm-hmm. when it comes to the money, what you made the point earlier was that, you know, the Republican money people are just as crazy and craven as the base. In some ways, they're more so, because at least a fair amount of Republican base voters, I think, would like a higher minimum wage. They don't want to cut Medicaid. Wealthy Republican donors are people that, yeah, maybe they're most socially moderate, but they don't really care. Their agenda is the same agenda as what you said. It's that extremist counter-revolution to strip away the social safety net and let extractive industries have free reign. Like, that's the game. They're not hiding the ball. Democratic yep. donors are, you know, anything on a spectrum from maybe a kind of genuine sort of, you know, on the most benign end, and I know people have a lot of problems with him, but you know, a benevolent-ish kind of guy like George Soros, who clearly thinks like, okay, I don't have a problem paying some more taxes so people can have health care. And I have some understanding that there's a society and there needs to be some investment in that. Then you have people that, you know, we need to give to both parties and spread the money around. And then there's, you know, hey, I'm pro-choice, but I also am an Israel lunatic, and there needs to be a certain kind of Israel policy. You know, the point being that there are plenty of the Democratic money, as you pointed out earlier, does not synchronize with that leftward focus. So the money is distinct. And then that also creates another situation where, you know, in terms of who's in Congress and who's in power in the Democratic Party, there still isn't even, you know, uniformity on the basics. There isn't even, you know, we'll see if everyone votes against Jeff Sessions. But I mean, that isn't even like leftward unity. Voting against Jeff Sessions means that you are an opponent of neo-Confederate politics. That should be a kind mm-hmm. of very baseline position of being part of a 21st century center-left party. So
right.
what's the material answer to that problem? Is it, you know, getting away from the big donors? What's the story there?
Right. So just to underline yeah. what you said about lack of conformity on the basics, right. in 2015, the Senate Democrats tried to agree on a climate policy right. that they would vote for after the election, and couldn't even agree on, you know, cap and trade or a carbon tax. There's really, really disagreement on basic issues.
Right.
And you're totally right. That has a lot to do with the donor networks. To put it very bluntly, if we want the Democratic Party to become more progressive, we can't do it while relying on the money of billionaires. And a big part of the Democrats' problem right now is that the only sane place to get the money you need to be a competitive national party if you're going to be a center-left party is labor unions.
Right.
And Democrats really made a conscious decision over the course of the past 20 years that sort of the labor movement was a dead end, it was going to die, and they should place their hopes elsewhere.
Right.
Whereas the Republicans, you know, they're very anti-union. We might see national right to work this year or next year during this administration. And part of that is obviously ideologically they hate workers, but another big part of it is that they realize that the unions are a very important source of funding for progressive policies, and there's this tactical argument for destroying unions. And Democrats really, they don't think like that. They don't think, whether we think unions are popular or poll well or not, they're an important part of our coalition. They look at the polling and they're like, okay, well, that was nice for a while. We'll try to get our money elsewhere. And there are never going to be as many billionaires who are ready to donate to raise their taxes as there are who are going to donate to lower their taxes.
Right. It's just interesting because it's like the party that is obviously much more represented with professionals and academics and is, you know, more intellectual, but it's like Democrats are more cerebral, but Republicans are way more strategic. That's the kind of, like, we get stuck in these, like, oh, this is an interesting Vox explainer about how some thing works in the government that, you know, whatever. But more Republicans are like, I don't know any of those details. I just know that if we can strip labor unions away, we can both reward our people, push our agenda, and incidentally kneecap our opponents. I mean, that's strategy. And it's that, you know, it's the party of, like, less intellectualism has been infinitely better at understanding how power works.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I think the Democrats think in terms of building a natural majority, and the Republicans think in terms of taking their country back from those people. And anything they can do to destroy those people, they are happy to do.
You know, that's exactly right. I know, finish your thought. It just goes back to the 90s because, you know, in this modern, like, if you go back and look at, like, the Clinton history that you alluded to earlier, you know, now the debate kind of got positioned and we need to move beyond this very quickly, that there's some type of contradiction between being serious about overcoming structural racism and social progress with income inequality in that crisis. They're, of course, totally interconnected. And the same people on the sort of wing of the party that don't want to be serious about inequality, their sort of forebearers in the 90s were actually willing to do what they fake Bernie Sanders does, which is that they were actually willing to race bait. They were actually willing to even play with the base in those ways in order to triangulate to the center.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. And an important kind of memory to preserve that, again, a lot of people who are in their 20s and 30s and maybe in the Clinton wing of the party don't really remember that.
Right.
But that's, we know very clearly what it looks like for the Democrats to sell out racial minorities because it was done.
Right.
Like, it was
not that long ago.
First way possible.
We were already born. As a final question, though, you know, you're right that the Republicans have gotten away with it and they've benefited, but now we're seeing, you know, and this is another, you know, Democratic messaging failure, obviously. But now that Obamacare is actually on the table and people see what it actually means, we're going to play footage in the second half of Republicans fleeing from town halls. We had the leaked tapes last week of these Republicans all of a sudden, you know, they're scurrying like rats on a ship, because when it actually comes to, okay, now it's on the chopping block, and my constituent, who maybe last week they were emailing me an Alex Jones article about Muslim drinking water or whatever, but now all of a sudden I'm going to take away their pre-existing condition coverage. That matters, and there actually is a backlash. So do you think that as part of this overall strategic frame that, you know, when Republicans are actually fully in a position to do all of this, is there a backlash to it that doesn't even rely on Democrats not being strategic? Like, it's almost incidental to them because the assault on people is so intense.
I mean, that's the hope. And I wrote that article before the inauguration and before we saw this tremendous backlash. And things are looking a lot better for Obamacare than I thought they might be.
Right.
I think what that speaks to is that, if you were running Clinton's campaign in October, it turns out what you should have said is the Republicans will kill children. and you should have said it again and again and again.
Exactly.
And
by the way, Republicans, not just Trump, the whole system, they all want to do this.
Absolutely, yes. Exactly. And they said it over and over again. And I think people at some level didn't believe them. You know, if you try to pull people on, what do you think of Paul Ryan's plan for Medicare? People will tell you outright, I don't believe anyone in American politics holds this view because it's so deeply unpopular. And I think
and sociopathic. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And sociopathic.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And I think voters, mainstream voters, but also the Democrats themselves, sort of didn't really, again, it's a failure of imagination. They didn't really see how serious these people were. And now that they do, I think we're in a completely new situation where, yes, voters are absolutely rebelling against a plan that would strip healthcare from 20 million people.
Right.
And I think what we're seeing is Democrats in Congress, you know, struggling to keep up with the radicalism and the horror of not only their base, but just ordinary people in Kansas who are about to see their health care stripped away from them. So to me, that's very, very hopeful.
Yeah. And I think maybe they could finally learn. I think that the subtext of your article, and it's so important because there's been this paradox, I think, culturally on the left where people on one hand, we are way more willing to say like, oh, Paul Ryan couldn't possibly want to do something that vindictive or cruel, or even the kind of conversation that people got really obsessed with before, you know, when everybody thought Hillary would win, of like, you know, are we just in these elite bubbles? And, you know, what are people really, and then at the same time being like, basically assuming like, hey, the Republicans are idiots and they're not as good, and we've got the analytics and we've got Barack and all of this kind of cultural signifier of sophistication, when in the fact it's the exact opposite. It's actually like, look, don't worry about being in your bubble. Don't worry about thinking that Paul Ryan is a hidden heart. He doesn't. They don't. It's political trench warfare. And on the flip side, you know what? Steve Bannon, you know, Breitbart beat Google. Like, these people are way more savvy and strategic, in fact, than we've wanted to realize. And, you know, that I think is the kind of paradox of our political moment. And I hope we're getting that. And I really liked your article because I think it expressed it very well.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah. And it was a pleasure to write it for Current Affairs. And thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Michael Cunican, I hope I pronounced that correctly. I don't know why I'm having trouble with that one. Sorry? Cunican.
Cunican. Yeah.
Journalist based in Brooklyn. The piece is in Current Affairs. There's a link on our website. Also an editor at The Hypocrite Reader. Michael, I will talk to you soon. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye.
Okay, everybody. We're going to get to the fun half of the program. Subscribe to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. Fresh one dropping tomorrow. Spread the word on the Majority Report. Write the Majority Report in iTunes review. Write Two Dope Boys in a Podcast in iTunes review. Tweet at me about the meetup if you're interested in that. @_MichaelBrooks. JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. All of the descriptions for all of the deals are always in the blog posts and on our sponsor page. So even if you're a member, you could still access them. We'll see you on the fun half, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. The IMs are open. Say it's an apple.